NIH. Oh, dear. Came down here with the understanding that I would spend half of my time doing my own research. Well,
okay.
Do you have any tissue? Well, I don't want to wipe it on my pants.
He just got the subject just got ink all over his hand. So this is Nancy Campbell and Joe Spillane on January 4th, 2007,
okay.
About to interview Roy Pickens, who just got ink all over his hand. So just give us a second, Elaine, and we will get back to you soon. We can just let it run.
You don't.
She'll skip it.
You ever heard of the Three Stooges?
Yeah, just as we started the recorder.
We've now recorded this.
That's okay. The transcriber will ignore all of this.
Right.
At least I didn't swear.
Well, here's I don't know what's. It smells like a cleansing.
I just got back from a cruise, and now they're so tight on everything that you can't. If you go into the dining room, you have to get this stuff.
Is this the pen?
Yeah.
Well, let's toss that.
Squirt it all over your hands and everything like that.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And it's
too many sick ships.
Yeah, that's what he said. They're walking around squirting the stuff in everybody's hand all day long. I said, well, they don't want anybody spreading the flu.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, there's all genetics and. This is a great place to do that type of research. And then the other half of my time to assist Bill Dewey and as Associate Vice President for Research. Unfortunately, after I'd been down here for a very short period of time, our university was closed down because of IRB problems. Okay, and our president said, "We've got to get back on our feet. This is terrible." And looked around to see who had NIH experience, and of course, I had NIH experience, and so I never saw a research lab since. It's been all IRBs and consent forms and.
How sad.
Yeah.
All right, well, we want to take you back to those days in the lab. This is Nancy Campbell and Joe Spillane interviewing Roy Pickens on January 4th, 2007. And we want to take you back to how you got into the field in the first place. What was your pathway? What drew you to the field?
Well, I was in graduate school at the University of Mississippi at the time, and I was interested in seeing if the effects of drugs could be conditioned. And I turned that into my thesis proposal. And I was trying to condition the activity effects of amphetamine. And found out that I could do that, and I got very much interested in drugs at the time, and and then that moved on to reading an article by a man named Jim Weeks, who worked at the Abbott Laboratories, I believe, in Michigan. And not Ann Arbor, but somewhere up there.
Yes.
He had developed a little device which would allow animals to press a lever and receive an injection of morphine, I believe it was. And so this was back at the very beginning before anybody had done anything.
When? What year are we talking about?
63. You didn't know there was such a year, did you?
I was born in that
year. Okay.
All right. Well, there you go.
That hurts even more then. I had worked with amphetamine. Mm-hmm. And then I got interested. Well, okay. Well, you think rats might inject amphetamine, which was not a drug that produced physiological dependence, would they do the same thing? And I thought that was a fascinating question because it was not an opiate drug. There was no physical dependence associated with it. The question was, would these animals inject that? And so I needed to go to other places to get the money and equipment and all that. And so I applied for a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Minnesota, working with Travis Thompson. And so I went there, and as a postdoctoral fellow in the psychopharmacology training program, mm-hmm. and also as I was a postdoctoral fellow a relatively short period of time, and then I got a faculty appointment there in pharmacology at first, and then in psychiatry and pharmacology a year or so later.
Were you his, an early postdoc of his? Did
yes.
Griffiths and Bigelow
they
kind
came
of
later.
Follow you?
They mm-hmm. came okay. later. I might have been his first, I'm not sure.
And had you had any previous contact with addicted persons or with drug
no.
users of any kind?
No, didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. But of course, I started to quickly learn about it. This was in the mm-hmm. early 60s. And then the drug abuse epidemic swept the country. And people would come and ask us to give a talk at this high school or for PTA or wherever. And my research started to trail my talks that I was giving. And so I was giving talks and doing research at the same time. And the area of research that I was interested in, again, was that amphetamine, because mm-hmm. it didn't produce physiological dependence. And I remember distinctly the trouble that we had on the very first publication that we came out with. I don't want to mention the name of the person who was the editor of the journal, but it was the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics. And this person simply did not believe the data that we were presenting to them. And since I was the principal investigator on the project, it was, you know, well collected data. These animals were pounding away at the lever, getting mm-hmm. drug injections, losing weight because this is an anorectic drug. there was no physiological dependence involved, and yet they were still, their behavior was still being maintained. And so we had to, then I switched over to cocaine. It was a shorter acting drug. We didn't get such dramatic weight loss in that drug. And maybe I'm going into too much detail here.
No,
but
no, not at all.
We, if you can call it, it's good for us to have it.
Okay. So anyway, so the cocaine was very interesting, and I remember the first paper was on cocaine, and the editor said, "I don't believe it." And the reason that he didn't believe it, and I think this is very important, had to do with the current definition of what is a reinforcer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And at that time, a reinforcer was viewed as an event that increased the rate of responding for it. And what people did not realize was the reason food increased the rate of lever pressing had to do with the size of the food more than anything, rather than food per se. And I remember taking some monkeys and to prove the point to the editor, you can guess what I did. I duplicated the situation with food that we had seen with drugs. And that is, the animal would pull a chain in the cage, and the instead of getting a little piece of food this size, like a rat would get, he might get 100 of those pellets, or 200 of those pellets. Okay, and lo and behold, guess what? The animal's rate of responding went down. Okay? And so I think we convinced them, and we had in one journal article, I had one page that was a list of controls that we had employed. But the point is that it wasn't the substance per se, it was the size, the magnitude of the reinforcement. Boy, it's been a long time since I've thought about these things. And so they accepted the paper.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that they made us call it something else other than reinforce. Oh, they tried to, and then I was adamant about that. And so they let us call it reinforcement. That's what they did. And you recognize that this has been years and years and years since this actually happened. And I don't recall every little detail. But I presented as an assistant professor at the American Psychological Association. Remember, it was in Chicago. Presenting a paper, and it was on magnitude of reinforcement and response rate in monkeys. Okay. I assume that you all understand when I say reinforcement and magnitude of reinforcement and all of that, would you understand what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, rest assured we have interviewed many behavioral pharmacologists.
Okay. And at any rate, I had that paper, and it was you know, the effects of magnitude of reinforcement on response rate in rhesus monkeys. And you're naturally nervous when you're that young and you're giving a paper anywhere. But I remember immediately before I gave my paper, B.F. Skinner walked into the room and sat down right across from me. And I was just, I was just devastated by the whole experience. And I gave my paper, and then when I finished, he got up and left. Now, it could have been a coincidence, but it certainly rattled me. And but I think he really came, because I think he understood at that time that the definition of a reinforcer needed to change, and it could no longer be just the rate of responding had to go up. Mm-hmm. That in under certain circumstances it can go down. You know, it depends on those circumstances.
Sure.
And magnitude of reinforcement was one of the main ones.
Yeah.
But I got interested in this, and then got a research grant to study, I think it was called behavioral dependence on non-narcotic drugs. And the key was non-narcotic drugs, because everybody else had been studying the narcotic, the physiologically dependent producing drugs.
And who issued that grant?
Ah, NIMH, because NIDA did not exist at the time.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and later NIDA was created, and the grant was transferred from NIMH to NIDA. Mm-hmm. And I can remember the grant number. It was 000027 or something like that. It was one of the first.
It's interesting. Many people recall their earliest grant number for NIDA.
Yeah.
So did what? Oh, you had.
I just wanted to, before we move too far forward, I wonder if you could maybe try and characterize the state of knowledge at the time that you're beginning, particularly non-narcotic drugs. What was the state of the field like at that point?
I think there was one person, guy's last name was Yanagita. He was in the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I think he had examined a whole wide range of drugs. He had not concentrated, he was a pharmacologist. He had not concentrated on the behavioral aspects of drug self-administration by animals. He was more interested in what could he get animals to self-administer, and he just tested a lot of drugs and moved on and did other things and all that. And so I came along interested in the real science of behavior and what was what was going on here, and how this applied to human drug dependence. And so we started talking about drug dependence as being, and I remember the sentence that was in the publication, that drug dependence was just a special case of a drug serving as a reinforcer. Now that really goes back. And then that grant continued at Minnesota for years, and I remember I learned a horrible lesson with that grant. Over time, we hired many, many people, and we did a lot of research. And then when the grant was like 13 years old or 14 years old or something like that. It was not renewed, correctly so. It was not renewed, and I remember having to go and telling all of those people that I didn't have funding for them anymore. That was horrible, you know.
Yeah. So you stayed at Minnesota a long time.
I was at Minnesota first as a postdoc, an assistant professor, associate professor, and a full professor with tenure. Now, I left Minnesota in 1985 and went to NIDA as the director of their division of it really honestly has a name.
1985.
Now there's going to be a 2-year discrepancy because I did not resign from Minnesota. I was not sure if I was going to like working for the government. So what I did was to take a leave of absence. And during that time, I worked for the government. And after 2 years, they called me in and they said, look, you got to fish or cut bait. You can't continue to do both things. And but when I first went down there, I remember that I had 2 grants that I was the PI on. And NIDA told me I could keep both grants while I was working with them, which, if you think about it, was ridiculous. And after I got down there, they then told me I had to surrender both grants.
Mm-hmm. And who was the director when you first went to NIDA?
Bill Pollin, mm-hmm. P-O-L-L-I-N. And right after I got there, he left. Okay. And then Jerry Jaffe came in. Jerry was the director of the intramural program in Baltimore, but he was also serving as the acting director of NIDA while NIDA sought a new director. And they finally found one, who was Bob Schuster. And Bob and I went way back together because we did very similar research. So we knew each other very well.
Mm-hmm. And when you first went to NIDA, you were division of...
I'm trying to think of the exact name of it. At NIDA, they have a tendency to change the names of all of these divisions. Clinical Research. Okay. Division of Clinical Research. And then, that was in 1985. And at that time, NIDA was not involved to any significant extent in the AIDS problem. Mm-hmm. And I remember writing a letter and saying we should be involved, that one of the main vectors for the transmission of HIV was intravenous drug use and sexual contact with the intravenous drug abuser unprotected. And the result was that I got also appointed as the Institute's associate director of AIDS.
And was that under Bob Schuster yet, or was that before Schuster?
I think I think Jaffe put me in that position. I think. And I think our budget at that time was like, it was either $3 million went to AIDS or $600,000, I'm not sure. It was nothing compared to what the other institutes were getting for different purposes. Now, every Monday morning or every other Monday morning, I had to go down to the Humphrey Building, which is the building right down the hill from the Capitol, from the front of the Capitol, and it's where Health and Human Services was located. And the Ash, Assistant Secretary for Health, would convene a meeting of people who had responsibility for these various areas. And we had to report on what we knew. And at the very beginning of that, we knew practically nothing about AIDS. And we were terrified. Mm. We were absolutely terrified because CDC, their representative, Jim Curran, reported that, according to their estimates, that by the year 2000, everyone in the world would be infected with HIV. Okay, and we were terrified because we didn't know what to do. We didn't know, and the only thing that we could... Are you sure you want to hear this? Because yeah. It is related to drug abuse.
Oh, absolutely.
But, okay. So anyway, we had we didn't know what to do, and we had to do something. The public expected us to do something. The president, on the other hand, did not. Was not as concerned with the issue as we were, and we were very concerned with the issue, and so the only thing we had to offer and I represented the drug abuse area, okay. And the only thing we had to offer was education. Now, our charter or our mandate or what would you call it? It's
mission.
Mission, right, was to conduct research. Nothing in there about do education. And so we started off just doing education and doing it as fast as we could. And then somebody pointed out that we were breaking the law. And so we switched over and told all of these people that we were giving money to. And our budget was starting to go up like this. And we basically could get anything we wanted at that stage. As our budget went up and we were doing the education, we had to switch over and start to put that education within a research context.
So how did you start doing education? How did that work? Who did
we it? Knew people in the community. It was based on the people that had done research. It was researchers out there in Miami. Miami was a hotbed of AIDS. Puerto Rico, hotbed of AIDS. New York, good Lord, I mean, that was just a lot of AIDS. And then they discovered HIV. And we started talking about HIV somewhere in here. and the International AIDS group was formed, and we would meet all over the world and with other people because they were having problems like that. And I can remember being concerned about Thailand because Thailand had a lot of intravenous drug abuse. They had a lot of prostitution, okay? And I can remember that we this collected group of people that represented various areas. For example, there was somebody from Heart, Lung, and Blood doing this aspect of it. There was somebody trying to find the virus or find ways of killing the virus. You know, my area, my responsibility was the drug abuse part. It was a real mess at that time, and we were getting money being poured into it. And I can remember one time we had $40 million that we shared with NIMH. And the $40 million was to educate, and NIMH was really looking for a mission at that time. They did not know what their role was going to be. We knew what our role was going to be, and it was education. But we were running head on into the issue of cleaning needles, which we were not allowed to do. Okay, so we couldn't put Clorox bleach. We couldn't let that word appear in a grant. So we had to have. So we had to go back to our researchers and say, no, don't put that word in there. Put miscellaneous supplies in there, with the understanding that they were going to be buying bleach with that.
Did the researchers know that they were, I mean, they must have known that they were being used to do this educative function, right?
Oh, yes, but there was a lot of money flowing their way, too. Now, we went from practically nothing up over the course of 3 or 4 years up to $170 million or something like that.
So how were you able to, I guess, how did you set priorities in terms of research?
Well, at first it was all education.
Right, but then once...
And I think one thing happened that changed that. And I had to go down every year and justify our budget, NIDA's budget, and up to that time, our budget was all education, but it was education within the context of epidemiological studies. So what do we know about people that have never been in treatment programs before? We had zero information on those people. We had to, and I remember the technique that we used was called a snowballing technique. Find one person, then when you do the interview and remind them about the risk factors and tell them what they should do to protect themselves, then you say, do you have any friends? Or do you know anyone else that's using drugs that we could talk to? And they would give us that person's name, and then we'd go into it, talk to that person. And this was going on in I don't know how many cities around the country, Seattle, I mean, just practically every state. And we were putting this money out as fast as we can. And it was not high quality research. Okay. As a matter of fact,
by what
I have
standards are measured.
I have the data right over there. By what?
He says it wasn't high quality. What do you mean? I mean, what was it lacking?
Well, all the projects were exactly the same. Yeah. All the projects were epidemiological studies right. of people who had never been in treatment
right.
before, but every one of the projects that we funded was of that nature. Okay. And we asked really interesting questions of people about their sexual practices, mm-hmm. about their drug use practices, about all of that. So it was certainly interesting data. Mm-hmm. It has never been published. Okay. I happen to have a copy of the thing because it came out of my division. Okay. But it was the fact that it was never published is significant, I think. So
the now you're sounding like an epidemiologist. That must have been, you know, at some distance from your behavioral training.
I was a director of the division.
But you had to do some learning in order to kind of grow into that.
Yes, I mean obviously. I mean we learned epidemiology on the fly, mm-hmm. as it were. And it turns out that was primarily what we were doing in those early days. Now, one thing happened. I was about to say this.
Right.
One thing happened when I went down one morning with everybody else on the... This was called the PHS Executive Task Force on AIDS.
Okay.
The PHS Executive Task Force on AIDS. It was the highest group of people in the federal government charged with developing ways of controlling the spread of HIV infection in the country. Mm-hmm. So there were some pretty influential characters there. Tony Fauci was a member of that group, and Fred Goodwin was a member of that group, and I don't know if you know these names, but the people, it was a very, very, and frankly, they didn't know what to do either. We were all kind of lost in this thing, but we knew it was spreading, and we knew it was spreading rapidly. Bob Batches, who was with NIDA, he was my deputy. I had two deputy directors. He was my deputy director. One of my deputy directors. We put together a study, which may have had the best science associated with it, where we went into methadone maintenance programs and started asking people in methadone maintenance programs about drug abuse and their knowledge of HIV infection. But the important thing that we were doing is that we were collecting blood samples to see if they were HIV positive or not. And we repeated this every 3 months. And what we were looking for is any trends. Was it going up? Was it going down? Was it remaining about the same? And what we found after 2 or 3 years of collecting this data was that in the IV drug abuse community, the rate of HIV infection was not increasing nearly as much as CDC was predicting that it was going to be increasing. And we published a whole number of articles on that particular topic. I suggest that you talk to Bob Batches. Unfortunately, he died a few years ago. But he was a very good guy. So, getting back to the story, I'd have to go down and I'd have to justify the budget. We shared $40 million with NIMH, and it was really to give them a mission of some type, because we didn't really know what was going to happen. They were a strong institute at NIH. We wanted them involved. We didn't collaborate with them in any way or anything like that, but it just made sense to have them in the game along with us. So, do you want these people?
Thank you so much. I'll see you tomorrow. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, I thought this was interesting that we had our budget and we'd go in there and we would go to the everybody was sitting around this small little room, and we would, in effect, say, this is our budget, and this is what we want. And I can remember this one guy, he was from CDC, and he was the head of the this budget group. And since it was $40 million, and also we started to talk in millions now instead of thousands and things like that. Since it was $40 million, they had 20, we had 20, and this was two-year money it had, had to be spent, and there was no talk about renewing it. And we were using this money to go out and collect rates of HIV infection in drug abusers in methadone maintenance programs. Okay? So we wanted that to continue. And this guy, whose name I can't remember right off the bat, said, well, Roy, what's this $20 million for? And I said, well, you know that $40 million that was given to us back 2 years ago, now that's set to expire. And I was about to say, and we would like to continue this, and we're going to need $20 million in order to continue this part of it. But I never got that far because I said, you know, that we needed this money. And he said, oh, you've got that money. What do you want this $20 million for? Okay. And I paused and I said, to improve treatment of IV drug abuse. Okay, because we thought that if we could improve the treatment of IV drug abuse, then we could make a significant dent in the AIDS problem. Okay? And we talked about that just very little. And he said, okay, that makes sense. All right, we'll approve that. Now, and then they went on to somebody else, and I'm suddenly saying, what on earth has that just happened? Okay, for one thing, I had done something without consulting my institute director. Okay, it was something that we had talked about in the division of clinical research, and one of the branches in that was the AIDS branch. It made all the sense in the world, but it just hadn't gone through channels and everything like that. So I got on the metro from the Park Lawn building and urged the train along, and I got back to NIDA, and I walked in, and Bob Schuster was in there, and Dick Milstein, who was the deputy director, was in there. And I said, well, let me tell you what happened. And I said, this is what we did. We got $20 million more than we need, and I've said that it's for improving drug abuse treatment. And then I think we wound up in the first year not being able to spend it all, and I think we gave $10 million of that to HRSA or somebody like that, whose mission was to try to integrate drug abuse treatment into the main medical stream of things. Okay. But that continued the next year and everything like that, and got bigger. Okay. And so, and this is important, the mission, our AIDS mission changed from epidemiology, okay, to much more so toward the improving drug abuse treatment. Now, it was after this, sometime after this, that they made me the scientific director of NIDA's intramural research program, and I went to Baltimore. Okay. And I understand, you know, they continued to do this, but by that time, the the people that watch over the shoulders, you know, they say in government there's a natural progression of things. One is the first, there's a disease that occurs, and then they find the epidemiologists come in and identify the vectors of that, and then this happens, and this happens, and finally the inspector general comes in to see how the money was actually spent, whether it was spent wisely. And they had some objections to the way this money was spent, and then what they did is, as I understand it, because I was 40 miles up the road at that time, they had to show in the grant proposals how this was actually related to drug abuse. Okay. And I think a couple of years later, they had to drop pretty much all of that out. But for a period of time there, we had a very intensive program going to improve drug abuse treatment. And to my mind, that was the most important thing that came out of that. I mean, we could have done the epidemiology, and we knew what the epidemiology, you know, and repeating that, unless you're looking for trends and things like that, didn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
But improving drug abuse treatment as being how what we do did make a lot of sense.
Now, was drug abuse treatment, I mean, service delivery was sort of separated. That was not what NIDA was doing, right? There was a split between
that
research
was a
and...
split, yeah.
When did that happen? That was that when, like, SAMHSA started?
Yeah.
It was right in there, in that time period.
It was earlier than that, than when I went to the intramural program. What year that was, I don't know.
I remember because I interviewed Benny Prim, and he talked about being really upset about that kind of splitting away of research from service delivery. He was the acting director, I think, of CSAT at that point.
Yeah, he came down. Yeah, and yeah, there were a lot of people that were upset about that. Mm-hmm. I was out of the picture, out of that picture.
So by then you're in Baltimore. All right, so you have, I think, the distinction of, you worked for under Bill Pollan, Jerry Jaffe, Bob Schuster, and Alan Leshner, right? I mean, you're not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so this, so after we talk, you know, we'll want to talk, get you to do some comparative work, if you can, about what each of those administrations was like, but we'll sort of bracket that for later and come back to it.
Now, Alan Leshner, I really didn't work under him more than just a few days.
Oh, really?
Because it's not uncommon when a new director comes in, they reappoint their people, and I was tired of the intramural life at that particular point in time, and I went back to the lab, as they say. That's the phrase, meaning that you're no longer in that position. And so I really can't say anything about Alan Leshner, because I never really worked on him. But in what you left out is that in the intervening period, there were some other people that served as acting directors. One of which, Dick Milstein, he was acting director before Leshner came. He was after Schuster and before Leshner came.
All right, so let's talk about the intramural life.
Yeah. How is it that you went off to the ARC in Baltimore?
Oh, it was a plum. I mean, it was a definite promotion. I just love that. And it also caused me to expand my interest. I mean, I did not know anything about PET scans. I did not know anything about this or this or that. And it gave me a chance to learn all of those things. I mean, gee whiz, I mean, you get to learn not just what you're trained to do, but you get to learn, you get to do things that you're never trained to do, and which is interesting. I think of all of those things, though, I like the AIDS work. Okay, because in the Division of Clinical Research, we had four branches. One was community service, I believe. One was treatment. One was prevention. And one was, it had a different name, but it was the AIDS branch. And so those all fell under me, but by far the major activity, as our budget just was going up like that, was in the AIDS area. I've got some fascinating documents over there, like when testimony before Congress and and those kind of things.
Yeah, I'd love to see them.
Yeah, we would. Did the Community Epidemiology Work Group start under you? Or was that, had that already been going?
I think that was already going. I think it was George Beschner, I believe, who was doing that. I think that that changed its direction a little bit. Not because of me, but because of AIDS.
Yes.
AIDS was driving all of this
right.
at that time.
Right.
And we were asking for it was basically any we got what we asked for in the way of money.
Now, when you went to the IRP, it was still called the ARC then?
Yes.
So was that different? Given the excitement about AIDS and your sort of position and role in that rather tumultuous time, in a way, was, I mean, it must have been a little bit different at the ARC.
There were people there doing AIDS research, okay? Just like there were people doing every aspect of drug abuse research was represented at the intramural program. Mm-hmm. Every aspect.
Including genetics?
Oh, well, yeah, I did some genetics. I had my own little lab, and I did genetics, and I did the behavioral genetics. There were other people there that did molecular genetics. And we had, the guy on the right is me. The guy in the middle is Louis Sullivan, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And the guy on the left is Bob Martinez, who was the AIDS czar at the time. The other things are bragging. Oh, Bernadine Healy, who was the director. All of these people came up and visited us because we were a high-profile group.
Had there been a lot of genetics research at the ARC before you got there, or was it?
It was just like you have a bull by its tail. I mean, it's there are a lot of people doing a lot of different types of research there, and my job was to make sure they were doing that they had the resources that they needed to. But that reflected my philosophy. My philosophy was, you get your best people and you support them, okay? And that's what I did. And, I came into play when we hired somebody new. If we had about 60 or 65 or 70 postdoctoral fellows. That's how many people, postdoctoral fellows we had there. We had a number of regular government scientists who were there. We had a pretty sizable group. We had our own clinical lab. Have you been there? Mm-hmm. You've seen the clinical lab. You've seen, and while I was the scientific director, we got our PET scanning, neuroimaging lab. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's running that now.
New technology at the time.
And we got some money for that. We got some people that were we got money for that, and I don't want to go into all these details. But we got money for that, and I think it was about $6 or $7 million to outfit that lab. Never really used to its proper extent, but I can say the same thing about VCU. We got a neuroimaging lab here, and I don't think it's being fully used. So we had branches, and under the branches we had sections, and each section had a different purpose, and each branches to sections, and then you kind of go down another level, and we would have people in that. It was a rather large operation. Now, the person I want you to really meet is Mary Pfeiffer.
Yes.
Okay, now Mary, I think, is a good friend of mine. And not only that, but the executive director up there, Mary Affelt. Have you run across her name?
No. Mary Pfeiffer, I've actually, you know, met, had email correspondence with, but Mary Affelt?
Yeah, Affeldt. DTT, yes. Now, when I came in there, Mary was a GS 11 or something like that. I thought she was good. She had every personality characteristic that you'd want in an executive officer. She'd call me at night and say, "We talked about such and such, but we never got closure on that. Now, what do we want to do about that?" She couldn't go to sleep at night until she had everything nailed down exactly like we were going to do it. Now, when I left, Mary was a GS 15. That was the most remarkable climb you've ever seen. So Mary owes me. So I can get Mary to talk to Mary Affelt, to talk to Mary Pfeiffer, and we can get down into what's there. Now, let me tell you what's there.
Okay.
I've already told you there are actually two large volumes up there, huge volumes, this big, where somebody from the time the Addiction Research Center was created until the time it moved to Baltimore, clipped every article in the Lexington newspaper and pasted it in these scrapbooks.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Not science, but social. And a lot of times you can see a lot of this stuff. Now, I have worried about that. I have no idea what just happened to them. But I know this. The people that came in after me were not drug abuse people. Okay, Alan Leshner was not a drug abuse person. Okay, so he didn't appreciate this stuff. Like the drug abuse people appreciated this stuff. Barry Hoffer is not a drug abuse person. Okay? And so, I don't know, they may have thrown it away. They may have said, "Let's get rid of this stuff." And it's what's just taking up space. And that's why Lou Harris and I have wanted to get up there and get that archived.
Mm-hmm.
And preferably get it out of NIDA.
Yes. And it has to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Now there are two, well, there are files from Lexington in Atlanta because the National Archives has a southeastern branch in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And the stuff from Kentucky went there. There's just a cart full. It's not very much, but it is what the PR department, they had clip files from the national press in boxes. And so there are about, I don't know, there's maybe 12 lineal feet of records at Atlanta. There's very little at the National Archives. There's a little bit on the early history from the 30s, the opening, Lawrence Cobb, etc. And the National Library of Medicine,
well,
which is...
a lot on the early history, actually.
Yes.
It's voluminous and absurdly detailed. I mean, every scrap of...
paper, just like letters and things.
Yeah,
like that.
Sure.
I've
looked at them. It's
not very,
you know,
useful.
Every detail on how much corn they were growing in the field. I mean, whatever they were. I mean, it was a lot of administrative stuff.
The sewing machines and you know, these things.
Yeah.
So the National Library of Medicine has Lyndon Small's papers and Lawrence Cobb's papers, and we think that maybe Lou Harris's papers should go there. Or the problem is, what we would like to see is a specific history of addiction research archives somewhere. We thought we had achieved that kind of agreement at the University of Michigan with the Bentley Historical Library, but it's in Ann Arbor, and we're not all that thrilled about, and they're not, they're really interested in University of Michigan researchers, so they're interested in the Sievers stuff, and they seem to be balking when we, not balking, I mean, they still might do it.
No, not balking, I just don't think they understand yet why they'd want to do it, and not actually surprisingly, you know, they're interested in University of Michigan material. If it isn't involved the University of Michigan directly, they're not really sure.
Although they do have a collection
on... that's an important site of drug abuse research.
Yes, and, oh, sure. And we're hoping, it's still possible that they would go for the idea of an archives. They have one on gerontology, Nathan Schock, and they have some other people, you know, besides him. And I'm thinking something more along those lines. Now, whether Ann Arbor is the right place or not, it's, you know, that's one possibility. And the other possibility is the National Library of Medicine. If the National Library of Medicine is interested, that would be a very good thing.
I think so.
Because it's more where there'd be more traffic. And the problem that archives have are attracting people to archives. So when I went to the ACMP archives to look at the oral histories of you and many other people, it's at Vanderbilt, and it's a lovely archive.
You didn't look at police records or anything like that, did you?
Police records?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
Do you have one?
No.
so
do
the
background check.
But you know, there were really interesting things in those archives that weren't really supposed to be there, but there they were.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it's off the beaten path, and it's, you have to specifically know to go there. And so it would be nice to have this somewhere that people could use it. The problem with having it at NIDA is, frankly, this ahistorical government.
They don't care.
You know.
I mean, that's my reading of it.
NIDA is a wonderful place, and is certainly suitable for, you know, to house this material.
Okay, here is our question. What have been your relations with NIDA since your departure?
I think they've been good. I mean, I really haven't had any problems. I mean, a lot of the people up there were people that were promoted or appointed or selected while I was there. I know the people well. I think I have good relationships with the people. Mary Affeld, the executive officer up there, and there is no more important person than an executive officer in a place like this.
So do you think you could...
I hate to keep sort of breaking back and forth between kind of interview and business, but the volumes are, I mean, that sounds, first of all, that's extraordinary, and you could never replicate. I mean, that would... Anything else in terms of particulars, items that you were aware of that would be of interest that would...
Mostly, every year we gave the Abraham Wickler Award. I don't know if they still do that or not. Mm-hmm. Remember, when I came down here to finally do my own research, and then stepped into a hornet's nest with this university being closed down, and then getting that job, it has taken years to get our human research program back, and the reward I got for that is now I have the animal program under my direction too, I guess. So I have been so busy that I have not had time to interact with people. I feel bad about it. My former secretary, Faye Polchak, like, I feel terrible. I've never, I never have a chance to even pick up the telephone and call her. I have one friend. I have only one friend. I have one friend up there, Jonathan Katz. I have Jonathan works it out so that if I and there are things I know. For example, if you look on the NIH webpage, what you see is information that's available to the public, but what you don't see is information that's not available to the public. Well, part of that were the minutes of the scientific director's meeting and the minutes of the director's meeting. Okay. There's a lot of valuable information, you know, in those minutes, and they also have a lot of information that would be useful to a university in many respects. For example, what's available in terms of a human research program. For example, up there they have if you know where to go, and if you have access rights to those things, you can go in there and find out, take a disease, all right? And what somebody has done is they've taken this disease and they've translated it into ordinary, everyday language. So that if you're writing a consent form, you can follow that ordinary, everyday language, public language, and people will find that acceptable who are reviewing everything. So there's a lot of information like that. You probably won't ever get your hands on anything like that. It's internal. It's working memos. There are some things that I have saved. I pulled together some things. Some books. Have you seen this book, Careers of Opioid Users?
Oh, yeah.
You've got this?
Well, I have seen excerpts of it.
Is that right?
It's Maddox, of like Razor and Maddox, you know, at Lexington.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is it. This is the book.
Wow.
I have some hearings, AIDS hearings that I participated in. Mm-hmm. And they distributed them to the people. Some of these old books are just really classics.
See, I'm not sure what the NIDA library, you know, how much they...
I don't know if they'd let you have these anyway. I will certainly let you have these. I would like to see these things preserved. And there's some just absolutely great books in here. One of them is about the early history of the Addiction Research Center. That is, in my opinion, the most valuable book.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I have an old library copy of that that is falling apart.
No, it's a fascinating.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's a fascinating thing. The list of participants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really an extraordinary sort of thing. Has a reunion aspect to it. I guess it is a reunion aspect.
And we have done things like when some of the old hands retired at intramural program.
Yeah.
People that started off over at Lexington. We would hold a little party for them over at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And basically everybody got drunk is what happened, because we would sit there and we would drink wine. And then the other old hands would start to tell stories about what the Addiction Research Center was
like.
Did
anybody ever
record
or? Yeah, that's the.
I can tell you those things, but I can't provide you with a recording.
Clifton Himmelsbach's lab notebook
is
sitting in the lobby in a glass case.
Yeah.
It would be nice to look at it.
Yeah. Jack Henningpeel, when I was there, was the one who put it there. Mm-hmm. Have you talked to Jack?
Yeah. And I'm going to go back and talk to him again.
I
talked to him a short time, and
we
I really enjoyed
talking
to him. We
would like to do a follow-up.
Yeah, but so getting these things to a place where they could be used.
Here is this.
The other thing.
This is what you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, this is. These are the cities that participated in that AIDS educational effort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, man, I mean, just these are the variables.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this. I mean, this is the from male receptive oral sex and associated condom use.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't detailed, I don't know what is.
But this is not available?
To my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this kind of stuff is very important. To keep.
Yeah, and I've got the data too. I've got the data from this questionnaire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Anything that wasn't published is especially important. Correspondence.
Oh, now that's where Mary Pfeiffer can be of great help to you.
Okay.
Because. I was starting to tell you that we had this Wickler Award that we gave out every year.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I had to, when I was up there, of course, I had to be the master of ceremonies. And so to say something about this, I went down with Mary Pfeiffer, and we pulled out all of Wickler's correspondence, everything that the guy had written. Okay, so I know that's up there.
And you think it's in the library, or you think it's?
It's in the library, and probably only Mary knows where it is in the library. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have tons of stuff. This is locked.
Boy, that would be something to see.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna go.
What's that?
The correspondence.
Oh yeah, but it's boring. It's really, really boring because.
What do you remember about it?
Well, other than that it was boring.
Well, yes, pretty much.
And remember that historians have a high tolerance threshold for.
Yeah.
We have to, you know.
Yeah. But it was. We would like to have you visit us sometime. What would be a good day for you to visit us or something like that. No.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, there would be a lot of that in between.
Hmm.
photographs?
Yeah, I've got some old photographs.
You have some?
Yeah.
Here or with you? Or?
Yes, I do. You see, the word I got was that you wanted to sit down and talk to me.
Yes.
And I just kind of pulled out some things, mm-hmm. but I haven't had a chance to go through here and pull out everything that I have.
Yes, that's I mean, part of what we're today, a lot of the move within the historical profession is towards digitization, and what the NSF has basically funded us to do is to gather oral histories, but also to gather primary material that we can use, that can either be housed at the Bentley or it can be up on the web. And so we have a website, mm-hmm. UMSARC, the University of Michigan Substance Abuse Research Center, has a website that they're basically hosting ours. And so when we have primary materials, particularly photographs, we can post them on the website along with the interviews. And so if there's a particular place in the interview, we can basically link to a photograph. A lot of our interviews, of course, mention Lexington or Michigan, and mm-hmm. You know, because people began their careers there. And so we're looking for anything of that nature that people still have.
Okay. The bottom line is that, let's see, you bottom line is I'll take this stuff out. What I'm worried about is that, and I'll have to ask the guy next door, when I came down here, with boxes and boxes of material, and my research office was in that corner of the building, okay? And my administrative office was up in Sanger Hall at the top of the, the hill there. Then when I got so involved in the administrative part of the thing, I was not using my research office, and it was kind of silly to have it tied up like that. So I had some of the boxes move here into this new facility for us, and the other boxes stored in a storage room up in Sanger Hall. And Mike Newsom next door, right there, was fussing at me about moving that stuff out and get rid of that stuff. And I don't know what's in there and what's not in there. Okay?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff in there. Hang on just a